Welcome to this audio recording by the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. I'm Jim Falk, President of the Council. We are a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization dedicated to promoting public awareness of global issues and the ways in which they affect the Dallas-Fort Worth region. Become a member today at dfwworld.org and help us connect North Texas with the world. This podcast is made possible through the generous support of Haynes & Boone, LLP. We hope you enjoy it.
Well, this is fun and an honor to be back in Dallas. Pat mentioned I grew up here. My father came here in 1960 and was president of this little, at that time, little storefront bank called Lakewood State Bank, which was between Kirk's Beauty Salon and Doc Harrell's Drugstore and in Lakewood. And as a matter of fact, my parents were members of the World Affairs Council. And I remember that occasionally they would, I don't know if you still do this, but visiting businessmen, international businessmen, sometimes members of the council would bring them home for dinner. And I recall the first international businessman that I saw was a group of Japanese businessmen. I think they're the first Japanese men I ever saw. But they all had the cameras and everything. And the only thing I knew about them was that they were very delicate in their eating habits. And so I knew that much about the Japan. And so what are you serving them? And, well, we're serving them barbecued ribs and corn on the cob. You can't do that. And but indeed, our little dinner party with these guys, they seem to really enjoy for the first time in their lives getting their hands on the food. It's fun to be back here and be able to see people that we've known and people that had known my parents. I'm going to talk a little bit about who joins Al-Qaeda and why, and then I'd be happy to entertain some questions that some of you may have. In the 1970s, a very distinguished Egyptian sociologist named Saad Eddin Ibrahim did a study about the political detainees that were filling up the Cairo prisons at the time, the radical young Muslims. And he wanted to know, who were they? So to his surprise, he found that they were mostly well-educated young men. They were drawn to the fields of science and engineering. He called them model young Egyptians. Then in the 1990s, there's one of my sources and now good friends, Mark Sageman, who was a CIA case officer in Pakistan during the jihad against the Soviets and is now a psychiatrist. He did a study about the young men that had been drawn to the Al-Qaeda training camps in the 1990s. And the results of his study mirror, in many respects, those that Saad Eddin Ibrahim found. These were not impoverished social failures. They were college graduates that come from intact families, mostly middle to upper class. Many had, instead of being educated in religious schools, many of them had been educated in Europe or in the United States. Some spoke as many as 5 or 6 languages. There were no discernible mental disorders. In fact, many of them weren't even very religious when they came to join Al-Qaeda. In other words, they were a lot like us. So the question I think we ask is, why are they in Al-Qaeda and we're in the World Affairs Council wondering who they are? I think we have to go back to that Saad Eddin Ibrahim study. One of the things that he noted was that most of these young men had come from rural areas or villages into Cairo, Alexandria, Bani Suef, the university towns, the big towns, where they had no family, they had no connections, and they were greeted by these Islamist organizations and offered fraternities, a social network, and, of course, the consolation of their religion. As it happens, Ayman al-Zawahiri, who is now the number two man in al-Qaeda, the doctor that's always at bin Laden's side, had read Saad al-Din's study when he was in prison. And when he got out in 1984, he came to see Saad al-Din and he said, you have trivialized our movement with your mundane analysis. May God have mercy on you. And Saad al-Din said, well, you know, there's an old saying in Arabic. If you try hard and hit the mark, you get two nasibs. That's two rewards. But if you just try, you still get one nasib. And he said, very well, you can have your nasib. I think he was right about the sense that it was these young men that were away from their roots that made them vulnerable to this kind of radicalization. And indeed, this is one of the things that Mark Sageman found that was really pronounced. They call the phenomenon displacement. Most of the people who joined jihad in his study did so in countries other than the ones in which they were reared. Now, this is just as true for a Moroccan in France as it is for a Yemeni in Saudi Arabia. It's the element of displacement that seems to be common to so many of these young men. I think one of the things that's most disturbing about the recent plots that have been uncovered in the UK is how this sense of displacement seems to perpetuate itself through second and third generations. These young, in this case, Pakistanis, don't feel British. And the British don't feel like they're a part of them. They're not authentically one or the other. They're not Pakistani. And they're not British. So who are they? They feel marginalized. This is a phenomenon that you see all over Europe. Right now in Europe, in the Protestant north of Europe, there are more Muslims than Catholics. And in the Catholic south of Europe, there are more Muslims than Protestants. If you are Belgian, let us say, and the number one name for a child born in Belgium today is Muhammad, you think to yourself, what's happening here? What's happening to my country, my history, our language? You know, where is this going? You feel like your identity is at stake. And if you're Muhammad, you feel, these people don't want me. I'll never be one of them. This is not my country. But, I may never have been to Morocco. I might not even speak Arabic. It's that Muhammad who's in danger of being recruited. And it's natural. It's the natural thing that happens, that they turn to the mosque for people like them, for a sense of commonality, a sense of socialization, of fraternity. And it's also natural that the imams there minister to their sense of anger and alienation. But it's exactly that connection that makes Europe right now such a dangerous spot. Now, displacement doesn't explain everything in terms of the recruitments to al-Qaeda, nor could any one single factor. This is an organization, a movement that is made up as much with idealists as nihilists. Another thing that I would point to is the barren economies that so much characterize so much of the Muslim world. Half of the world's poor is in Muslim countries, but that's only one-fifth of the world's population. If you were to take all of the oil out of the Arab economies, and only a few of the Arab countries actually produce oil, the 300 million Arabs produce less than the 5 million Finns. Essentially, what we're talking about is this, a Nokia phone. This is the primary export of Finland. This is the phone I carried around with me in Saudi Arabia. Imagine the entire Arab world produces less for export than this one phone, one product. if you were to put oil back into those economies and then expand the pool to include the 54 countries in the Organization of the Islamic Conference, essentially the Muslim world, they produce less, their economy is smaller than that of Germany. So we're talking about barren economies where young people have little to look forward to. In many cases, the economies are growing, but at a slower rate than their populations. So instead of getting ahead, they're continually slipping behind. Now, another factor I would point to is the lack of civil society. And I had the opportunity to witness this. It was an opportunity I didn't really intend. The Saudis wouldn't let me in as a reporter. So for a year and 4 months after 9/11, I've been making application. I've been in Egypt and elsewhere, but I was desperate to get into Saudi Arabia. And it was pretty clear after a while they weren't going to let me in as a reporter. So I took a job. Now, they don't understand journalism, but they understand expat workers. I know that I met several of my colleagues here who have been expat workers in Saudi Arabia. So I got in for 3 months, and my job was to mentor young reporters in Jeddah, which is bin Laden's hometown. It was the briar patch for me. It was the best piece of bad luck, because instead of being stuck in the hotel like any reporter, making my telephone calls, I had a job, had a car, had to go to work every day, and I actually got to be acquainted with the society in a way that I would not have been as fortunate to do otherwise. Let me tell you what life was like for my young reporters. There were no movies, no theaters, no plays, no nightclubs, no music. There's no political life. I mean, there's no political life at all. There's no political parties. There are no labor unions. There are very few parks or museums. There's so little to do. That entire space of life that we call civil society is absent. There's nothing between the government and the mosque except shopping, which is a very serious enterprise in Saudi Arabia. Recently, there was a new IKEA furniture store that opened up in Jeddah. It was such a thrilling event that 15,000 people showed up. Two were trampled to death. Naturally, the absence of anything to do is depressing. And one of my reporters did a story about a study done at King Abdulaziz University, which was bin Laden's old school. 67% of the boys and 73% of the girls showed symptoms of depression. 7% of the girls in a Muslim culture had admitted that they'd attempted suicide. Now, I saw the toll that strict gender separation took on my young female reporters. They worked in an office under the stairwell. They were absolutely strictly segregated. In fact, you could go the entire day in Saudi Arabia and never see a woman at all if you didn't go to the grocery store or the mall. And then when you see them, sometimes, you know, they're so encased in black, you can't even tell which direction they're facing. I went to a mall once with one of my reporters, and I have to say the young Saudi men are so horny. It's sometimes just sad to watch. But we were watching these two young Saudi women. I guess they were young. They were completely encased. Even their eyes were covered. Going down the escalator, and my reporter said, "Check them out." So I suppose that after a while, the force of imagination can project itself right through those black clothes. Women were certainly deprived of many opportunities. I had to make a special arrangement to visit these women once a week so I could supervise their work. And this was unprecedented. They were three of them, and they would come up in this little black train into the conference room. They'd never been in the newsroom until I made this stipulation that I had to meet with them. And they couldn't go to news conferences. They couldn't go to the library except for one night a week. All the usual tools that a reporter has at his disposal were very hard for them. But I also noted the effect on these young men. They were so unsocialized. They had grown up without the company and the solace of women. And I think that that's one of those factors is rarely taken into account when we're talking about, you know, who becomes a terrorist. It's not so easy to be a terrorist if your girlfriend won't let you. And if you spend your life, your adolescence, learning how to please girls, which is a lot of what a young man's job is, and you don't have that opportunity, then radicalization sometimes has an easier opportunity to make itself heard. This kind of environment, this kind of meeting, would not be allowed in Saudi Arabia. For one thing, freedom of assembly is very carefully controlled, but the mix of men and women together is simply forbidden. And both of the sexes are extremely deprived by the nurture and companionship that they would otherwise have. Now, there's another factor that's a little harder for me to discuss. It's a little more abstract. And that is that word humiliation that you hear so much. It's probably the most common word in bin Laden's vocabulary. Humiliation and this consequent longing for revenge. Now, I remember watching a video of bin Laden in 1989. He had just come back from the jihad in Afghanistan. And he was making a speech in the bin Laden family mosque in Jeddah. And there were about 150 young men sitting cross-legged on the carpet of the mosque in front of him. And his topic was humiliation. And he said, "How we have become humiliated. We are like sheep," he said. And I thought, why is he humiliated? I mean, he's rich. He's from a very famous family in Saudi Arabia. He's famous at this point. He's probably Saudi Arabia's first celebrity. He had a small army at his command. So why does he feel humiliated? And why does that sense of humiliation obviously resonate with these young men who are nodding on the carpet of the mosque in front of him? Saudi Arabia has never even been colonized, so there wasn't that excuse either. Many people in the Arab world and the Muslim world have been humiliated in deeply personal ways. I, for one, think that the torture that took place in the prisons in Egypt, which was so brutal, characterizes the bloodthirstiness that is so notable about Al-Qaeda. Ayman al-Zawahiri, among others, was brutally tortured. And I think it warped them. I think that they came, and Al-Qaeda is largely an Egyptian organization in its hierarchy. I think that they brought that longing for revenge and the sense of personal honor being so deeply violated that the ordinary restraints on civilized behavior, even civilized terror behavior, which before Al-Qaeda was largely a theatrical event. Those restraints had been dropped. But that wasn't true of bin Laden. So why does he use this word humiliation and why do Muslims resonate to it? I think that there is a deep sense of cultural humiliation that goes throughout the Muslim world. You can actually date it to September 11th, 1683. Which is the day the king of Poland arrived at the gates of Vienna to relieve the Ottoman siege. It was the furthest advance of Islam into Europe. And then from that day, Islam began its gradual inexorable retreat into this kind of sullen isolation that you find it in now. And every Muslim knows this. Every Muslim knows that there was once a great Islamic empire and that it was the leading edge of science and art and industry, and that it has now fallen so far behind and continues to slip further and further behind. That is humiliating. And in Bernard Lewis observed, you know, that there was a question that was posed to Muslims by themselves: what happened to us? And somewhere along the line, that question changed into, who did this to us? That's where the longing for revenge meets this sense of humiliation. There's a feeling of wanting to get back at the world. There's a cycle. Now, that sense of humiliation is naturally compounded when, for instance, if you are in a relatively rich country like Saudi Arabia and you reach for a screwdriver or your Nokia phone or you will get a cup of coffee from Starbucks, everything you touch is made somewhere else. Your culture contributes nothing physically except the oil that you exploit. It's not just true of Saudi Arabia. Even in Egypt, you know, which had an industrial base at one point, even the Ramadan candles and things are all made in China. They've become so unproductive and so dependent on everything being made somewhere else. And that's a sign of weakness. And that's humiliating. It's once again a sense that even if you're a terrorist, you're using AK-47s and, you know, rocket-propelled grenades that are made, even your own, you know, terror tools, you're dependent on the technology of the West and the manufacturer of China. Now, the paradox in all of this is that Al-Qaeda absorbs that, you know, longing for revenge, the sense of humiliation, the feeling that, you know, our economies are barren and our political societies are repressive. It absorbs all that and channels that anger, but it offers nothing to those young men who give their lives to it. Al-Qaeda doesn't stand for anything. You know, there's in November, December 2001, American and coalition troops went through Afghanistan and they swept up a huge trove of documents, Al-Qaeda documents. They're called the Harmony documents, and you can access them online. West Point and other different institutions have been translating them. And thousands of pages of internal memos, military manuals, ethical debates. Actually, one of my sources at the FBI told me he'd been studying the Harmony documents when they first got them, and they were soaked in kerosene, but the guy that was supposed to light the match ran off because before he could get it done. So fortunately, we have all this. We've got the Al-Qaeda Constitution, which is just as detailed as a ladies' garden club with, you know, who does what and how many years of education they have. And we've got their employment contracts where you get, you know, a month free paid vacation and a round-trip ticket home, and, you know, you get health benefits. It was a pretty good job for a lot of them. All of this is in there, but there's nothing in there, not a single page, about Al-Qaeda's political platform. Suppose you took over Egypt. This is what you want, all right? You got Egypt. What are you going to do with it? What kind of economic model do you follow? Are you a Marxist or a Keynesian? Are you... You know, what's your policy on agriculture or the environment? How are you going to deal with our chronic joblessness? You know, how are you going to improve our education? Al-Qaeda's never thought about these things. If you sat down with bin Laden and asked him those questions, he wouldn't have the vaguest idea of how to respond to you. They're above politics, which means that they don't have politics. They don't know how to deal with real-world political situations. And this is actually a huge point of vulnerability and a way in which I think Al-Qaeda can be attacked and eventually destroyed in the battle of ideas. Al-Qaeda does offer one thing to those young men who join it. It offers death. When I was in Pakistan, I had the opportunity to talk to this very distinguished reporter named Rahimullah Yousafzai, who had covered the jihad against the Soviets. And by the way, the Arab Afghans, of whom bin Laden was one of the leaders, did nothing in that war. They were a negligible force. This is a huge myth that bin Laden has perpetrated. You've got to give him credit for being a spin doctor. There were only 3,000 Arabs that ever went to that jihad, and only a few hundred of them who ever actually got to fight. And they were a negligible force. In fact, they were an obstructive force. The Afghans shut them down a couple of times because they just got in the way. But they came back and had this legend about how they had destroyed the Soviet Union. But when Rahimullah came upon a group of Arabs out in Afghanistan in the early 80s, and they were camped outside in white tents, and he said, "What are you thinking? This Soviet Air Force will see you and they'll wipe you out." And the Arab said, "But we came to die." One of the paradoxes, when I've been talking to these jihadis in Cairo and Saudi Arabia and even in London, and you talk to them about the jihad against the Soviets, they didn't think they were going to win. They didn't go there to win. They went there to die. If you are talking to them now, that means they failed. I failed to become shaheed. This is something that you hear again and again. I failed in my mission. I didn't die. So there was a... This is where the roots of Al-Qaeda were, the soil that it grew out of. There was a death cult involved in this call to jihad. It was a call to martyrdom. For the young men who join Al-Qaeda, which we think of as a terrorist organization, it's not for them. For them, it's a suicide organization. Their own lives offer them so little. They have so little chance to make a mark on history, which is what every young person wants to do. Al-Qaeda gives them that chance to make history. All they have to do is die. Well, thank you. I'll be happy to take any of your questions. No, the question was, is there a single spiritual leader that... No, in fact, this is, you know, Al-Qaeda has become so diversified now. There are, in Europe and in the Middle East, there are a number of radical imams that, you know, that speak and for Al-Qaeda, more or less, or in the language that Al-Qaeda would use. Most of the Internet has become the repository of Al-Qaeda's thinking. It's now very accessible. You don't have to guess what they're up to or what they think about. And I've been reading these Al-Qaeda ideologues and strategists. They anticipated that Al-Qaeda's leadership would be destroyed. They knew that it couldn't endure. Even in 1998, Abu Bakr Naji was one of the major thinkers, and he was already beginning to write about the future of Al-Qaeda. And he and Abu Musab al-Suri and others were deliberately writing these manuals about tactics, propaganda, you know, the rationale of the, you know, how we're going to organize in the future, all of this to put on the Internet to leave as a legacy to young Muslims who would spontaneously create their own groups and take on the Al-Qaeda doctrine and have access to all the training and the military manuals. It's all there for them and always will be. So they anticipated this. And the spiritual thinking and so on is all a part of that. You know, they've crammed it all onto the internet so people can have access to it. Yes, sir.
You need to give us the answer. You see, these are sick. I mean, what's going to work with Al Qaeda?
There are people, and the question is, how can we deal with Al Qaeda most effectively? And you know, can we send women or even kind of a Peace Corps thing? The answer is that Al Qaeda is a diverse organization. People join it for different reasons. The inner core of Al Qaeda is unappeasable. A good example is Bin Laden always said his goal was to get the American troops out of Saudi Arabia, which is a holy land in his opinion. It's an opinion of many Muslims. And it was, he thought, desecrated by the presence of Jews and Christians and, for God help us, women to protect, you know, the Arabs. And in April of 2003, when Saddam was overthrown, the bases that the American troops were using were there. They were there to enforce the no-fly rule. The Bush administration announced that we're going to be withdrawing our troops from Saudi Arabia at last. They should have been withdrawn years before that. But, you know, at last we're going to do that. The very next month, Al-Qaeda began its attack on foreign housing compounds where some of these American troops and other expat workers were living. Well, it seemed pretty clear that they weren't going to be appeased by, you know, this, what I thought was quite a concession. And if you read the doctrines of, you know, some of, you know, Abu Bakr Naji and I think there's a guy named Fuad Hussein who's written a master plan for Al-Qaeda. In 20 years, they hope to, you know, establish a caliphate and create an Islamic army and then have an apocalyptic final battle with the unbelievers in the year 2020. That's their grand plan. But that's, for one thing, wildly crazy and utopian. It's not going to happen. But there are a lot of young people drawn into radical Islam for reasons that have nothing to do with establishing a caliphate. They're mad about Palestine. They're mad about Lebanon. They're mad about the fact that their communities they live in reject them. And they're just angry and they're lost. And so they turn to this organization which is hitting the West, which is the target that so many Muslims feel is responsible for their plight. My response about how to deal with that is, for one thing, we have to be more forthright about, you know, who we are. We have to attack Al-Qaeda's empty vessel, as you know, has nothing to offer these people. We have to be very forthright about that. I think we have to be really careful about the model that we set in the world. It's dangerous to compromise our values because people draw an equivalence. I was in Syria recently, and this young Syrian filmmaker said, you know, I live in a police state, but when I look at you now, I see us. And you can't let that happen. That's very dangerous because he wants, even people who hate America, value our system of justice, our transparency, our openness. Those are things they want. And when they see us compromising it, we've lost a lot. And I do think also we have to be more present in the world. If you're in the countries that I've been traveling in all over the Middle East and Afghanistan and Pakistan, you don't see Americans. There were nominally 40,000 Americans in Saudi Arabia when I was there. I never saw them. There was, you know, an American embassy. All American embassies in the world are like forts. And they don't go out. They don't have political officers. They don't have any cultural institutions. Their presence is erased. So essentially, we're in hiding, and that can't be allowed to persist. We have to be out there doing active diplomacy. I think it's something way in the back. Well, I think Bin Laden, although he is reduced in his capacity to operate, he's such a priceless asset for Al-Qaeda that it would be a great loss to Al-Qaeda. And I think the fact that he can continue to operate is such a rebuke to us in our capacity to deal with him that it emboldens other people to join him. But as I said in this op-ed piece, a member of American intelligence asked me, what should we do with him if we get him? And I couldn't do it. I couldn't write the scenario for the CIA because I am a reporter, but I did write it for the New York Times. Don't kill him because he'll become a martyr right away, and that's exactly what Al-Qaeda would like. But don't put him on trial in the U.S. right away. Send him to Kenya, where in August of 1998, Al-Qaeda killed 213 people, most of them black Africans. It blinded 150 people. Let bin Laden sit in a Kenya courtroom and face 150 blind people and say, I was aiming at an icon of American power. And then take him to Tanzania, where the same day he killed 11 people in front of another American embassy, and all of them were Muslims. But Al-Qaeda excused that because it was Friday and all good Muslims would be in the mosque. I think it would be an excellent place to ask, what does Islam really stand for? And then you can deal with the coal and 9/11, and you could go on to London and Madrid and Casablanca and Bali and Istanbul. There's so many other places, but just take him one more place. Take him to Riyadh, his home country, where hundreds of Saudis and expat workers have died at the hands of Al-Qaeda. Try him in a Sharia court, which is the only law he would respect. And if he's found guilty, he'll be taken out to Chop Chop Square in the middle of Riyadh. And the executioner is a famous figure in Saudi Arabia. He's a 6'5" black man with a huge sword. But one thing he does before the execution, he goes out to the crowd, which is composed of the victims of the condemned man, and he begs them to forgive him. And if they can't forgive him, the executioner does his job, and the body is taken to an unmarked Wahhabi graveyard. And I think in that way you can begin to roll back some of the awful legacy that bin Laden has left, because he is the most famous man in the world. He's going to be one of the most famous men in history. We're going to have to deal somehow. We're going to have to detonate that legacy now while he's still alive. Yes, sir. The question is, can the imams be influenced to become to raise up the more moderate voices of Islam? And this is actually happening, partly due to American pressure. The Saudis have begun cracking down on their imams, although it's very difficult, and these guys are, very entrenched. But there are more moderate voices speaking up against the tactics of Al-Qaeda, and some of them, interestingly, aren't imams but are ex-terrorists themselves who are in prison and have begun to reassess, especially in Cairo. The former leaders of Gamma Islamiyah and Al-Jihad have attacked the attacks on America on Islamic grounds, that, not only were they, suicide is against Islam and all these things, but also the hijackers were the guests of the United States. They had visas. And that in itself is anti-Islamic. I mean, those are arguments that are being made within the radical Islamic movement, not the moderate side of it. So there are ways that I think this can be argued, and even I hope, since political Islam is the strongest force in the Arab world right now, and as we democratize, as they democratize, they will assume more power. And I think that by beginning this internal debate, it'll make them, I hope, a more reasonable force once they actually do come to power in places like Egypt and elsewhere. Yes, sir. Thank you, Randy. Actually, I was on Anderson Cooper the other night, and I'm on Charlie Rose tonight responding to that question again, because the detonation of Clinton on Fox happened because my book, he brought up my, Chris Wallace said, there's a new book, and, the There's no doubt that Clinton wanted to get bin Laden. There's plenty of testimony within his cabinet, and I had spent lots of time with Dick Clark, early when Dick Clark wasn't talking to anybody, and he hadn't written a book, and he was still in the government. He told me about Clinton, with his fixation on bin Laden, and drawing Hugh Shelton, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, aside and saying, "Why can't we just drop some ninjas down in the camp? That would scare the shit out of them anyway." He just had this idea that, we got to get him. He directed the CIA to kill bin Laden. They failed. Now, it's my opinion that president and his successor were very poorly served by their intelligence agencies. And there's a reason for it. When bin Laden, when Clinton said, "Get bin Laden," the CIA couldn't get bin Laden. They didn't have anybody who could possibly pass through the membrane that Al-Qaeda had set up, which is not that hard because John Walker Lind is there and now Adam Gadan, but they didn't have anybody who spoke Arabic natively, who looked like that. Since the Carter administration, if you want to start laying blame, you can go through Republican and Democratic administrations. The human intelligence factor in our intelligence community has withered. There's been a sense that we can do it all by telephone. That's not true. And there's a cultural prejudice against hiring Muslims and Arabs who speak those languages natively. If you go up on the 7th floor of the FBI headquarters, this is an organization that made its reputation fighting the mafia and, to some extent, the IRA. Who's up there? Irish and Italian Catholic guys. Now, it's not surprising they were effective fighting the mob and the IRA. They came from those communities. They spoke those languages. They knew who they were fighting against. If you went up there and you found guys who spoke Arabic and Urdu and Pashto, then you would have an organization that actually knows the community that's struggling to contain. When we talk about a failure of imagination, a failure to connect the dots and all this thing, it was a failure of, in the CIA, Irish and Italian Catholic guys, and in the FBI, and in the CIA, you have Presbyterians and Mormons, if I can characterize the whole television. But they learn languages, they study these communities, but they're not from them. And they're not going to be effective until they have people that really represent them. When I was in Saudi Arabia the first time, the Ligat, the FBI, chief FBI officer in Saudi Arabia, converted to Islam. And they canned him. They pulled him home. Now, start with the fact that this is outright religious prejudice, But how much more open and available would that society be to him if he was a Muslim? Women are an interesting issue because there are some fascinating women in Saudi Arabia. But in Saudi Arabia, women get more degrees at every level of education than men. Doctorate, from college to upper tier doctorates. And yet only 5% of the women are in the workforce. It's probably the largest, most highly skilled, unused talent pool in the world. But women are not exactly a force for progress, not just in Saudi Arabia, but elsewhere. It's a very divided community. There are many women who feel that radical Islam is the answer because they haven't found any other answers. They've been through all these social and political experiments, Marxism, Arab nationalism, capitalism. They've failed every time. Political Islam has always failed when it's been tried. Sudan, Afghanistan, Iran, I've been telling my Islamist friends, it's like the crash test. Some dummies survive, but the car is always wrecked. So you know how it's going to turn out. But we have to go through it. Well, maybe they do, but I think that, you know, it's until women are more empowered, you know, I think that if you can look back on the women's movement here and realize that there were women who didn't feel empowered enough at the beginning of that struggle to think that it was important to fight for it. And they felt like they were somehow betraying their own, you know, the traditions and their mothers and stuff, you know, the background they grew up with. There's some of that, too. And the more power women begin to assume, and they're beginning to in Kuwait and Turkey and other, you know, some of these Muslim countries are representing parliament and so on. They are beginning to assume a little bit of power. Then I think there's going to be some momentum. And then I think that women will become more of a force for progress than for enforcing these really conservative social values that so many of them stand for. Yes, sir. I never really felt scared, but it's funny you mentioned Daniel Pearl. The first guy I interviewed in Pakistan was Khalid Khawaja, who Marianne Pearl holds responsible for Danny's death because he told people that Danny was a Jew. And, of course, Danny told everybody he was a Jew. It wasn't a secret, but he was implicated but not charged in Pearl's murder. And he was a really good source. But I did wonder, you know, who am I talking to? And he came over to my hotel room with his son, Osama. And he said, I would invite you to my house, but if something happens to you, I'm going to get in real trouble. I said, well, that's fine with me. I'd just soon have you right here. This gentleman in the back. I'm not sure. I'm not, you know, and I'm not optimistic or pessimistic. I do think it's a long-term struggle. It might not be 70 years, but it might, you know, it's going to be a generation. It's, you know, we live in a period of time where there's a lot of rapid transformation. And I've been very interested and impressed with what's going on in the Emirates and Dubai and Qatar and Abu Dhabi, where these are not democracies. But their societies are much more open, much more responsible and accountable. And so there's a system. Now, bear in mind, I don't think that this is Islam, because, you know, these are Islamic societies. And I don't think it has very much to do with, it's not entirely dependent on democracy, although I'm a great believer in the inherently moderating force that democracy represents. But I think that by making societies that are more open and accountable, you see the Arab spirit unbound. And they're creating very modern, relatively open societies very quickly. I think that that model can spread through the Arab world, especially in the Persian Gulf region, where there's money to make that kind of transformation. I think, you know, you have to disaggregate it. It's not going to happen that way in Egypt. But Egypt is much more susceptible to a democratic change than these tribal societies. There's no doubt that there's been a longing on the part of al-Qaeda to acquire a weapon of mass destruction. And it's not out of the question. In fact, it's surprising that they haven't done so as yet. We know they haven't done so because they wouldn't hesitate to use it. But, you know, so far that hasn't happened. If it did happen, it wouldn't be a surprise. It wouldn't be a surprise to me to see a radioactive bomb go off in Europe one day. I hope it doesn't happen. But I think it's something we have to be very aware of and have to work really hard on establishing allies. You know, we've become very isolated in this struggle. We can't allow that to happen. We have to defuse the Israeli-Palestinian crisis because it fuels so much of the, even though al-Qaeda has never really been interested in Israel, thousands of young men who are drawn into radical Islam do so because they're inflamed about the Israeli-Palestinian issue. We're crazy to leave that on the table. You know, We have to address that. We have to resolve it. And it's going to come at, you know, it's going to be a really difficult problem to solve. But it's not so difficult as seeing Paris blown up. So, you know, I think we have to really, really address that very seriously. And, you know, I think we also have to address our intelligence community and force them to actually hire people that are have the skill sets that we need to police this problem. And if we do those kinds of things, then I think we'd be safer than we are presently. And I think that we'd be, you know, better fixed in the future than we will be if we continue on our present trajectory. Thank you very much.
For more information about the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth, visit them on the web at www.dfwworld.org.